Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the Bush administration's efforts to spin the national intelligence estimate, particularly still trying to link al-Qaeda to Iraq. And we'll be talking in a moment with Dr. Juan Cole, who's a professor of Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and is widely considered to be one of America's leading scholars on contemporary Iraq. And he's also the author of Sacred Spaces and Holy War, which is a definitive examination of the Iraqi Shiites. And his weblog, Informed Comment, at juancole.com, is one of the most popular blogs on the web for its insight and analysis. And we'll also speak with Dr. Anatole Levin, who's a senior fellow with the New America Foundation. He covered Pakistan and Afghanistan for and the former Soviet Union for the Times of London, and we'll be talking to him about the panic within the intelligence community over the fate or the apparent fate of General Musharraf, who's been rebuked by his own Supreme Court. And there's a sense that the pillar of U.S. Foreign policy in that critical linchpin of a country, Pakistan, is on shaky ground. And then we'll speak with Dr. Elliot Cohen, who's an ethicist, media critic, and political analyst. He won the first prize of the 2007 Project Censored Award for his investigative reporting on the corporate takeover of the Internet. And his new book is The Last Days of Democracy, How Big Media and Power-Hungry Government Are Turning America into a Dictatorship. So we'll be talking to him about impeachment and whether the reasons why people want to impeach, particularly Dick Cheney, in terms of his overreaching, anti-constitutional overreaching, whether the extent to which the Bush-Cheney have created within the government a kind of unitary executive, whether indeed they'll be handing that over to somebody like Hillary Clinton. I'm now speaking to Dr. Juan Cole, who, as I mentioned, is a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. He's the author of Sacred Spaces and Holy War, and his popular blog, Informed Comment, at juancole.com, is one of the most popular blogs on the web, particularly in terms of its coverage of Iran, Iraq, and the Middle East in general. Juan Cole, just this week in spinning the NIE, Fran Townsend, the administration's point person on Homeland Security, Condoleezza Rice, others came out and still insistently link al-Qaeda in the mountains on the Pakistan-Afghan border with Iraq. And they keep putting forth the idea that Zarqawi was in Iraq before the Iraq war, and therefore that's a justification for the linkage. I understand that you've got some information captured by the United States troops. In fact, isn't it an all-points bulletin that Saddam sent out to arrest Zarqawi?
That's right. The document was captured by the U.S. Once it invaded Iraq and has been released on the web. And the document clearly shows that the Iraqi Ministry of Intelligence had some information that Zarqawi might be in Iraq. This was, as I remember, around 2000. And they put out an all-points bulletin that he should be arrested, that he's dangerous. They gave his picture, most wanted style. And this went out to the intelligence operatives working for the Saddam government. Now, this document clearly shows that the Ba'ath government was not only not in cahoots with Zarqawi, but was actively afraid of him and al-Qaeda. And in fact, they described briefly that al-Qaeda was an organization of the Saudi terrorist Osama bin Laden, as though the intelligence operatives might not know what it was. This spin that Dick Cheney and others in the administration have all along attempted to peddle to us, that the Saddam Hussein government somehow was in cahoots with al-Qaeda, is completely disproven by this document.
But that hasn't stopped Vice President Cheney from going on national television claiming that Zarqawi got medical treatment in Baghdad before the U.S. invasion.
Yes, well, there's no documentary evidence for Zarqawi getting medical treatment in Baghdad, and Cheney's allegation that that couldn't have happened without the regime actively helping it to happen is simply not plausible in the light of this document. One of the features of the propaganda about Iraq is that it was a totalitarian regime. Saddam knew everything and so forth. We now know it was a ramshackle regime. It was barely standing up. It was easily knocked over. And there were all kinds of things happening in Iraq that Saddam wouldn't have known about. But the main thing is that it's very clear that Saddam was not supporting al-Zarqawi, that the government was afraid of him.
And indeed, the only place that he was in Iraq was that piece of territory in the Kurdish north, right on the Iranian border, which was territory that Saddam didn't control. Had he been in Saddam-controlled territory, wouldn't have lasted a minute. And this is he was with, apparently, the Ansar al-Islam group, right?
He was with the Ansar al-Islam group, which did contain some Kurds that had fought in Afghanistan. The other thing to say is, of course, Zarqawi was not, in fact, an Osama bin Laden acolyte. He was a rival of bin Laden's. He wasn't exactly al-Qaeda. And the U.S. had an opportunity to bomb that Ansar al-Islam base in March of 2003 and declined to do so, apparently because it might have removed a casus belli, a reason for going to war. So now the news is coming out that Ansar al-Islam is among a handful of guerrilla groups in Iraq that are forming a political party, and there appear to have been negotiations or contacts between them and the United States. So all of this is very rich in irony.
But I understand, though, when the U.S. invaded, that the special forces, along with the Peshmerga, attacked that enclave near the Iranian border, and they killed a bunch of them, but they witnessed them literally going over the border into Iran.
Yes, well, after the invasion of Iraq, the Kurds had been being bothered by those people, and so they insisted that the U.S. help them do something about it. The border between Iran and Iraq at that point is very mountainous and rugged. There aren't checkpoints, and what's on the other side is Iranian Kurdistan, which Iran does not control very closely. So, of course, if you're a Kurdish jihadi, if you were attacked in Iraq near that border, you would go over it.
So, how do you explain how Zarqawi, who I understand is a Salafist or a Wahhabi, at least he's on that side, how would he have survived in Shiite territory?
It wasn't Shiite territory.
Oh, I see.
Iranian Kurdistan is Sunni.
So he infiltrated back into Iraq through the same territory. In other words,
probably.
He didn't have to go down to the south into Shiite territory.
Well, he may have had to pass through at some point. Zarqawi came from Afghanistan to Iraq. He may have had to pass through Iran, but that's not so hard. There are lots of people passing through Iran. There are all kinds of pilgrims who go from the Arab world to Lebanon and so forth to Shiite shrines in Iran. And Zarqawi, as a terrorist, would have been willing to dissimulate his identity as he passed through.
But this, Juan Cole, leads you to wonder about the fate of this so-called al-Qaeda in Iraq, given that the U.S. is now working with the Sunni tribes in Anbar, and CNN has footage of them rounding up and assassinating and beating up so-called al-Qaeda people. And we know that the Shiite the dominant Shiite government has no truck with them. So they're between a rock and a hard place, aren't they?
Well, they've always been exaggerated. First of all, there's not really any al-Qaeda in Iraq in the sense of people who owe fealty to Osama bin Laden and are undertaking a mission for him, or at least that's a very minor thing. It's been revealed in the last week that the U.S. only has 135 foreign fighters in custody, and of those, about half are Saudis. 135 people is a very tiny number. In fact, the U.S. has 19,000 Iraqis in custody. So it's obvious that most of the suspected insurgents in Iraq are Iraqis. They're mainly Sunnis who are Iraqi nationalists and don't want U.S. troops on their soil. And these foreign fighters and the supposed al-Qaeda are a very tiny group, and they may be significant in doing car bombings and things, but to imagine that they can take and hold territory against the will of the Iraqi Sunnis, of the Iraqi Shiites and the Kurds, indeed, you have to think that, you know, what would the Ba'ath government in Syria or the Turkish secular government in Ankara, the Jordanian monarchy, what would they do about the threat of having al-Qaeda held territory nearby them? Those people would all be dead if all those forces were allowed just to operate normally. And it's the U.S. presence in Iraq that attracts those foreign fighters to go volunteer and fight them.
So what is the motive of the United States government, the Bush administration, to keep trying to make this link and to keep pushing the notion that the ubiquitous al-Qaeda has moved into Iraq, and they refer to them more often than they do the, you know, you just pointed out this 130 of them in captivity as opposed to 19,000, mostly Sunni. So they completely ignore the nationalist, the dominant nationalist insurgency, and keep playing up this mythical al-Qaeda.
Yes, well, Bush, in a speech this week, said that we are fighting the same people in Iraq now that attacked us on 9/11. And this is a lie. This is propaganda. It's coming from Karl Rove, and it's no different in form or intent than Nazi propaganda of Goebbels in Germany in the 1930s. And
what's its purpose, though, Juan?
Well, obviously, it is an attempt to rally the American people for the Iraq War by making them think that this is a natural extension of the attack on 9/11. And people were very upset about being attacked, understandably so, and something obviously should have been done about being attacked and preventing further attacks. And Bush is saying that it's the war in Iraq that is the natural outgrowth. But as you point out, in fact, the real threat to the United States is a reconstituted al-Qaeda, and the reconstitution is happening in northern Pakistan, not in Iraq at all. And that's an area that the United States hasn't done much about, and in fact has farmed out to a corrupt dictatorship in Pakistan, and which hasn't done a very good job with it. So this is all just—it's spinning the American people yet again. It's propaganda, and it is a lie. I was very reluctant earlier in this process to accuse Bush of out and out lying, because I can't know what is exactly in his mind. But the evidence for duplicity is mounting so quickly, and the things that are being said are so detached from what we know to be reality that I've just concluded that he is lying.
And in terms of what just took place with Ambassador Ryan Croker calling for the State Department to issue visas, exit visas, to Iraqis that work for the United States Embassy inside the Green Zone. Apparently, he did that to preempt the fact that a lot of the Iraqis that work for the Americans are finding a way out because they feel their lives are in jeopardy. Is this indicating that people are deserting the sinking ship? I mean, Senator Hillary Clinton sent a note to the Secretary of Defense, which was answered by the sort of remaining neocon there in the Pentagon, Eric Edelman, who was sent over from Vice President Cheney's office, to replace Wolfowitz. He apparently wrote back, well, he did, it's the text of it's available, a rather nasty response questioning her patriotism and so just accusing her of aiding and abetting the enemy. So is there anything to the idea that we may have to withdraw under fire?
Well, it's certainly entirely possible that the United States military will have to withdraw under fire. At some point, we're not going to be able to keep the number of troops we now have in Iraq there. The army is vastly overstretched. You've had these long rotations of a year and 18 months with continuing and constant contact with the enemy. It's something that even in World War II was very rare, and a very large number of our troops are just exhausted. Their equipment is getting worn out. We only have 10 fighting divisions. I think we have 6 of them in Iraq now, and they need to be rotated out and rested and restored if we're going to maintain more morale. So the troop number is going to go down, and as it goes down, you see, the army in Iraq becomes more vulnerable. The fewer troops you have there, the more likely the remaining ones are to be attacked by the guerrillas, both Shiite and Sunni. So yes, we could have a withdrawal under fire, and Hillary Clinton was quite right to inquire from Secretary of Defense Robert Gates as to what contingency plans the Pentagon has for such a withdrawal. And obviously, this neoconservative Eric Edelman, the number 3 man at the Pentagon, is attempting to play politics with her request by representing her as treasonous for making it. It's a perfectly legitimate request, and indeed, I mean, what one's fear is that Cheney and his cohorts are forestalling such contingency planning because they think that if there isn't a contingency for withdrawal under fire, then the generals will be forced to tell the president that they can't withdraw.
Well, this is all very well, but he's essentially doesn't control the insurgency, and nobody seems to. Isn't that where the real surge is happening? And if the other shoe drops, and there's indications now of more and more Shiites getting into battle with the United States military, this is the very army that we've trained. We recently had a shootout with them and captured an officer. What's your sense on whether the Shiite shoe will drop?
Well, it's also entirely possible. The United States military has essentially allied with the Shiite forces against the Sunnis to this point. But now there's an emerging U.S. alliance with some sections of the Sunni Arab guerrilla movement against these foreign fighters, or what they call al-Qaeda. And the Shiites are very disturbed by this development, and the U.S. is now announcing that the Mahdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr and the Butter Corps of Abdulaziz al-Hakim, these are Shiite militias, are a dangerous element of instability. And if the U.S. Attempts to fight essentially what is a war on two fronts against both the Sunni Arab guerrillas and the Shiite militiamen, then I think it's entirely possible that their situation will become untenable and the whole thing will collapse.
And what is the connection? Because I understand that we've, again, as much as we've been fed this these lies and pablum about the al-Qaeda connection in Iraq, it's also, I understand that the al-Mahdi army, they're basically more actually pro-Iraq and not so much surrogates of Iran as the others are, and particularly the Maliki government. And it seems to me pretty obvious that if you're threatening Iran with attacks, which have been pretty much clear to everybody, and we know that Ahmadinejad and company are paranoid, and perhaps they're exploiting those threats. But it would seem to me that there's no incentive for the Iranian government to do anything except cause trouble for us in Iraq.
Well, obviously, the U.S. has given the Iranian government every reason to play spoiler. So what's amazing is that so far the Iranians have not taken that bet to any great extent. The Shiite areas have been relatively calm. The Iranians have repeatedly asked the Shiite areas to remain calm. There haven't been large numbers of of attacks on U.S. troops by Shiite forces. There have been some engagements where the U.S. has attempted to repress the Shiite militias. The main militia group, as you say, is Iraqi nationalist, doesn't like Iranian influence. Some elements of it may feel differently, may be in touch with Iran, may get training in Iran. But on the whole and by and large, I would guess something like 95% of casualties among U.S. troops in Iraq have been at the hands of Sunni Arab guerrillas, most of whom have been supported by the Saudi and other Gulf publics. So it's the allies of the United States and not the enemy of the United States that are fueling most of these deaths.
But as you mentioned earlier, one call, the other shoe could drop. If we provoke a fight with the Shia, then our situation would be totally untenable.
Yes, well, you know, the United States military depends on fuel that is brought up to it in Baghdad and the Sunni Arab areas from the Shiite south, from Kuwait and from Basra, going through Mahdi army-held territory. So if we go to a major struggle against the Shiite militias in the south, or if we attack Iran, and they do have some fellow feeling with the Shiite Iranians, those fuel convoys, as Larry Johnson and others have pointed out, could be sabotaged. And without fuel, the U.S. military in the Sunni Arab areas would be sitting ducks.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles today, Dr. Juan Cole.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking then with Dr. Juan Cole, who's Professor of Modern Middle Eastern and South Asian History at the University of Michigan. He's the author of Sacred Spaces and Holy War, and his popular blog at juancole.com, Informed Comment, is considered one of the best analysis of Iran and Iraq. And I'm now speaking with Dr. Anatole Levin, who is in London. He's a senior fellow at the New American Foundation in Washington, D.C., and he's formerly a senior associate of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And he covered Pakistan, Afghanistan, the former Soviet Union, for the Times of London. And let me ask you about the extent to which perhaps there's reports of Musharraf's death are premature. There's apparently NBC News and others reporting that the intelligence community are in a state of panic. They feel that this linchpin, this pillar of our foreign policy in Pakistan, is on shaky grounds. What's your diagnosis of his position?
Well, I think he is on shaky ground. Indeed, I'm pretty certain that sooner or later he will either have to compromise with the political opposition or he will in fact have to step down, particularly since the last decision by the Supreme Court to reinstate the Supreme Justice who he tried to get rid of. But on the other hand, I don't think this is any reason for panic in Washington. The Pakistani establishment has, as a whole, I mean, whether it's Musharraf, it's the army in general, it's by far the greater part of the political opposition, including Benazir Bhutto, they have no choice but to work with the United States to a considerable extent, because they're very afraid of the United States. They're also very dependent on the United States. Equally, whether it's Musharraf in power, Benazir in power, some other politician or some other general in power, none of them are going to be able to do everything that the U.S. wants, or indeed a lot of what the U.S. wants, because the vast majority of the Pakistani people won't accept that. And if they see, and especially if ordinary soldiers and officers see Pakistan just becoming a sort of satellite of the U.S., then you would see really serious internal trouble. And, you know, people are now saying, oh, you know, Musharraf is our linchpin. But people have been complaining bitterly about the failure of Musharraf to do everything that the U.S. wants and needs in recent years. But that's going to be true of every Pakistani government. So whichever way you look at it, it's going to be, I would say, unsatisfactory, but probably not disastrous.
Now, Anatol Levin, are you saying that the portent of the Talibanization of Pakistan is being exaggerated?
Well, I was there in May. I actually went to the Red Mosque and interviewed its leader. And the striking thing was that not just all the moderate parties in Pakistan, but most of the religious, the Islamist parties as well, condemned the Red Mosque movement, condemned its leader, condemned its militancy, including the majority of the Islamist parties who form the government of the Northwest Frontier Province. And so that's the first thing. The second thing you have to remember is that even at their very highest at the last elections, all the Islamist parties put together only got 13% of the vote, 13. You know, that's not remotely enough to carry out a revolution in that country. So, I mean, the threat in Pakistan, and it's a real threat, indeed, you know, we're seeing it happening all the time now, and it's got worse as a result of the Red Mosque, is terrorism, you know, acts of violence against the state and against politicians who oppose them, including Benazir Bhutto. But it's not that, you know, we're facing something like Iran in 1979.
I spoke last week with Pervez Hoodbhoy, the Pakistani physicist, and he felt that the problem, you know, that they have a dismal choice in Pakistan between military dictatorships that we support and kleptocratic civilian governments. So in other words, he said, you know, we have a choice between dictators and thieves.
Well, I'm afraid he's absolutely right on that. I can only agree, except that there's a third choice, which is, of course, indeed Islamist revolution. But because, you know, these people claim to stand for honest government and land reform, egalitarianism. But of course, their victory would be disastrous for everybody.
So where do you see, if indeed Musharraf, and apparently the more he appears on television, he doesn't come across as a strong, decisive military leader. He's been sort of petulant and whining a bit, and his rebuke from the courts, tried to fire the Chief Justice, that's obviously backfired on him. So, in other words, what would it be? Another general with some kind of democratic patina? Could they bring back somebody like Benazir Bhutto and have some kind of half military, half civilian government?
I think that's the most likely scenario. In my view, most probably one of two things will happen. Either Musharraf will make a compromise with Benazir, in which he will stay on as president, he'll step down as army chief, and she will be allowed to become prime minister as the head of a coalition government, though. I mean, the PPP is never going to win a majority. At most, it'll get 30%, so it'll have to make alliances with other parties, including parties very close to the military. But either Musharraf will agree to that, or sooner or later, he will have to step down. But in that case, in my view, the army, the high command itself, will manage the transition back to, you know, a kind of democracy. I say a kind of democracy both because the army, in fact, will go on running so many things behind the scenes, including, of course, security policy, but also because, as Pervez Hoodbhoy pointed out, the civilian parties too, in general, represent, you know, very corrupt landowning and urban boss elites.
Feudal, really, isn't it?
Sorry?
Feudal, really.
Well, feudal is one word for it. Yeah. And the thing about Benazir's party is that it's, you know, it's feudal to the core. She comes from one of the biggest landowning families in Pakistan, and so do many of her leading supporters. And it has to be said that when she was in power, they did almost nothing for social and economic reform in Pakistan. So, yeah, I mean, nothing that's likely to happen is going to very much advance the cause of progress there. Equally, I don't think that, you know, simply the fact of Musharraf leaving power or having his power radically cut back is going to lead to some, you know, catastrophic overthrow of the existing system. Because the system in some ways is very strong, and the army is very strong. And the army will, in the last resort, you know, fight and kill to protect its interests and what it would see as the interests of Pakistan.
So the loose nuke scenario is grossly overstated then?
Well, in the short to medium term, yes. I mean, the army says, and I believe it, that it has those nukes under very tight control. The only short to medium term scenario in which those nukes would get loose is if we were crazy enough to invade Pakistan and the army were to split and, you know, parts of it were to mutiny, you know, against the government and so forth. But I mean,
by the way, Fran Townsend more or less said that in her briefing this week, that, you know, if we had actual intelligence on Bin Laden in the Northwest Territories or in Waziristan, we would go in spite and anything that the Pakistanis said.
Yeah, we might just, I mean, if we could go in and get Bin Laden and quickly and get out again, then I think we'd get away with it. What the Pakistanis, and I think anybody sensible, is afraid of is if we were actually to go into Pakistan in an effort not just to get Bin Laden, but to crush Taliban support in Pakistan or in the tribal areas of Pakistan, because there is massive support for the Taliban among Pashtuns in Pakistan. And so if we did that, we'd get involved not just in a raid on Pakistan, but, you know, in a war inside mm-hmm. Pakistan. That's the only thing that I can see in the short to medium term which would break up the Pakistani army and lead to large parts of it, you know, actually joining the Islamists in a war against us. In the longer term, what really matters is, you know, whether Pakistan can develop socially and economically and can also get a grip on, you know, what are really, I mean, apocalyptic environmental threats over the next couple of generations to the country.
Just specify those briefly, if you could.
Well, the thing is, you know, the Himalayan glaciers are melting, which means the water flow in the long run is going to be greatly reduced, on which tens of millions of people depend. There is a serious risk that the monsoon is going to weaken, so there's going to be much less rain. And already you see really acute water shortages in many parts of the country. So, you know, you're facing a scenario in 100 years' time in which you'll have 250 million people living in an area which is as dry as the Sahara Desert, much of it. But, you know, here we're talking several generations ahead. I mean, that's not a threat for the present. It's a threat that we ought to be worrying about intensely. Of course, we're not.
But it's a global threat as well.
It's a global threat. But if you know, after all, global threats have local effects.
Sure.
And one of the countries which is most endangered is Pakistan.
Let me then just focus in, if I can, Dr. Anshul-Levin, on the firing of the Chief Justice and how it's backfired on him. I understand that even though the issues that have been made public, they don't really make a lot of sense, why he was fired, that I thought that I'd heard that the subtext was that there's been over 600 people disappeared, most of whom I think are Islamist radicals, but they've been disappeared by the ISI, the Inter Service Intelligence Agency, and the families of those people were suing, and he was going to give them standing. This, then that's why they canned him. So what do you know about that?
There are two sides to it. That is indeed one of them. At which point, of course, you have to ask, where have they been disappeared to? Well, I mean, some of them have, of course, just been murdered. Others have been disappeared to America, or rather, you know, to American custody. That's what, you know, does put the American government in a very complicated position, shall we say, when it comes to demanding, you know, the defense of human rights and democracy in Pakistan, because it is, of course, completely illegal under Pakistani law. But yeah, that's one side of it. The other side, though, is that the thing that really sparked this off is that the Chief Justice was trying to, or has in fact now successfully maintained, that it is unconstitutional for Musharraf to be both president or to remain president after the next elections and to remain chief of the army. And Musharraf thinks, for very good reason, that it's extremely important to his power to keep both. But it does now look that this is not going to be possible, and so this will obviously push Musharraf still further towards some kind of compromise with Benazir Bhutto. There is one thing that one has to say about this, though, which is that, you know, there's been widespread portrayal of Musharraf in places like the Washington Post and so forth as this ruthless dictator, you know, like analogous to Mubarak in Egypt or even to the extremely, you know, bloodstained Karimov in Uzbekistan. Well, obviously, that's nonsense. If Musharraf were really a dictator of that kind, or the Pakistani system were so autocratic, none of this business with the Supreme Court would ever have happened. you know, the Chief Justice would have been in a cell by now or executed.
Right.
You know, which brings home the fact that, you know, actually, you know, one of the things about Pakistani governments is not that they're so strong, but that actually, compared to governments elsewhere, they're very weak when it comes to getting what they want. And one shouldn't be deceived by the fact that, you know, governments in Islamabad come and go. The question is whether a government in Islamabad is capable of changing the whole system. And the evidence has been that almost no government in Islamabad, whether military or civilian, can do that.
No, indeed, a military dictator who dotes over his little Yorkshire terriers is not exactly a picture of a killer. But just in closing, Dr. Anatole Lieben, the role of the ISI has always been murky. Some people suggest that they are, in fact, the de facto government behind the scenes. They became very powerful during the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan, where we outsourced that war to them, and they funneled U.S. and Saudi money. There's the assumption's always been that they've been organizing and benefiting from the enormous heroin trade in Afghanistan, and that they are in fact allied to a lot of powerful industrialists. So, give us a sense about the relationship between this shadowy, so-called de facto government and Musharraf.
I don't think the ISI is in any sense an alternative government. The ISI is military intelligence, and it's made up of seconded military officers. It's not, in fact, unlike the CIA, it's not a separate agency. It's, you know, it is part of the military. It's more like, you know, the Defense Intelligence Agency in the U.S. If you're looking for a shadow government in Pakistan, it's not really the ISI. It is the dozen or so senior generals who are the corps commanders, the area commanders, and the chiefs of staff and deputy chiefs of staff of the various services. And the ISI answers to them. It is, however, I think, sometimes, as in other countries as well, very convenient for the army to turn a blind eye to what the ISI is doing, just as they turned a blind eye to what, you know, the nuclear scientist and smuggler A.Q. Khan was doing. And, you know, don't ask, don't tell. Mm-hmm. You know what you have to do, get on with it, but don't tell us about it. And, of course, that does leave a space for radicals and adventurists to do certain things. But in the end, they will obey the Pakistani High Command. And the Pakistani High Command is the alternative structure of authority in Pakistan.
Well, just in closing, you're in London, Dr. Anatole Lieben. I understand that the new Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, is actually getting high marks from everybody, and that he has effectively banned the term the global war on terror, and he's also urged people to be judicious when they refer to Muslims in a much less incendiary way. But both seem like extraordinarily helpful. I wish it could happen over here.
Well, yes. And I mean, on the latter point, one of the reasons he's doing that is precisely that there are so many Pakistanis in Britain. And, you know, we're very worried now about Pakistani terror, well, Islamist terrorism in Britain. And so, you know, he's very anxious to try to win over moderate Muslims here and not to offend more people. On the other hand, you know, the government is stressing how it also, you know, America is its most important partner and it very much wants to keep close relations. So I think, I mean, what you're seeing is in an interesting way is that the governments of Britain, France and Germany are all coming to adopt pretty much the same position, which is, you know, they all stress their desire to get on with the US. Nobody is looking for a fight with the US. But all of them are now saying, you know, we mustn't have a Blairite policy. Mm-hmm. We must be able, you know, to maintain our independence and maintain our own positions and not be seen simply as American poodles, because, of course, that perception was disastrous for Tony Blair.
Yeah, and I wonder how Tony Blair is really going to be effective in this job, which I believe, and I understand that that Bush basically wanted to give him some kind of a payoff, a kind of golden parachute. So at the same time, Bush, I think, feels that he has to pay off Condoleezza Rice, who's been completely marginalized by Vice President Cheney. So how can both of them pull off this peace offering between the Palestinians and the Israelis?
Well, I mean, you know, if Bush were prepared really to back them and were to tell both Cheney and the Israel lobby to go away and were to try to really rally support in the Republican Party, then maybe they could achieve something. Although, you know, the question then would be what the Democrats do. But I'm very much afraid that in present circumstances, you know, there's no chance of that from this administration. And therefore, you know, we'll simply see the same charade, if you like, you know, farce of recent years, but now with Tony Blair co-opted as well.
So both he and Condoleezza Rice are going to look like fools at the end of the day,
well,
or useful idiots. Useful idiots, as the KGB used to say.
Useful idiots, but then there's nothing new about that, is
right?
There? Blair has looked like a useful idiot these past 5 years.
I thank you very much for joining us from London, Dr. Anatole Lieben.
It was a pleasure.
Bye bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Dr. Anatole Lieben, is a senior fellow at the New American Foundation. He was previously with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the Times of London's correspondent in Pakistan and Afghanistan in the former Soviet Union. And his latest book is Ethical Realism, A Vision of America's Role in the World. I'm now speaking with Dr. Elliot Cohen, who's an ethicist, media critic, and political analyst. He's the editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Applied Philosophy, and he's the editor for Free Inquiry magazine and the author and editor of many books on journalism, professional ethics, and philosophical counseling, including News Incorporated, Corporate Media Ownership and Its Threat to Democracy. He's also the first prize recipient of the 2007 Project Censored Award for his investigative reporting on the corporate takeover of the Internet. His new book is The Last Days of Democracy, How Big Media and Power-Hungry Governments Are Turning America into a Dictatorship. And before we get to both of the books on where net neutrality stands and how big money and power-hungry governments are turning America into a dictatorship, in terms of the resurrection of the notion of impeachment in a respectable way, if you will, in a non-hysterical way, which it's essentially been dismissed by Nancy Pelosi as kind of angry Democrats wanting to pay the Republicans back for the travesty of impeaching Bill Clinton. I spoke last week with John Nichols, who was on the Bill Moyers show with the conservative legal scholar Bruce Fine, and he makes a very sensible argument why it's actually patriotic and in the national interest to impeach Cheney, basically, but to Cheney and Bush. My question to you, Elliot, and I've read some of your recent writing, is that given the evidence that Bush and Cheney have created this royalist, as the founding fathers warned, unitary executive. They have broken the law on a catalogue of occasions. So there's a huge indictment against them in constitutional terms. But the bottom line is they've created this extraordinarily powerful network within the government of their acolytes, and I'm wondering, having pushed the envelope in constitutional terms as far as they have done, are these people therefore going to hand this whole mechanism over to Hillary Clinton?
In my estimation, no. I think that they've worked too hard to amass the kind of power structure that they've amassed to simply give it over. And one of the recent writings of mine is this article from BuzzFlash of last week. This summer, will America officially become a totalitarian state? And so I think it's that close. And the reason why I said that was, first of all, one thing that the media hasn't been talking about is the national continuity policy that the White House, Bush, signed on to and put up on his website, the White House website. And essentially what this does is bypass Congress and put him in charge of all three branches of the federal government if indeed there's a catastrophic emergency, and where a catastrophic emergency is defined so utterly vaguely to include virtually any kind of hurricane that's destructive or a terrorist attack. But when you tack that on to the recent gut feeling that Chertoff was espousing last week, and on the
terrorists were going to attack,
right, yeah, on the heels of the recent national intelligence estimate, which says basically that Al-Qaeda has intensified even pre 9/11 and the borderline of Afghanistan and Pakistan. When you add that and these warnings going on, well, basically democracy now is hanging by this very thin shred of either deliberation or chance that there won't be a natural catastrophe as vaguely defined by the national continuity policy. So is this imminent? Are they going to let it go? I think that the more probable bet is that they're going to officially declare this country under martial law. And I think people need to know about that. And so the idea of impeachment that you brought up is extremely important. What are we going to do? And if they don't impeach them, these fellows quickly, then the scenario that I hate to make alarms here, ring alarms, but I'm afraid that that will come to pass inevitably.
So you're suggesting that they have to impeach him now to take away the power of the his continuity of government plan. The COG is a long-standing government plan. It was particularly prevalent during the Cold War against the Soviet Union because of the fear of nuclear war, mm-hmm, and the continuity of government meant that the president would go off to these underground bunkers or to the airplane.
But they gave a role to Congress, and this one doesn't apparently do that, and it puts Cheney in charge of deciding whether there's transition to another president. And when Cheney was asked to find a vice president, guess who he came up with?
Who?
Him.
Well, you know, he's the only guy that doesn't belong anywhere in the Constitution. He's neither in the executive branch or the legislative.
No,
branch.
He's his own.
He's somewhere
nation.
Yes, and I was much relieved that we didn't have another war when he was in charge for a couple of hours yesterday. I thought that was very good of him not to attack a country while Bush was having a colonoscopy. So you've made some very, very incendiary remarks here, Dr. Elliot Cohen. So give us your sober scenario under which we could end up having martial law in this country and that Bush would not be replaced in 2008 by a duly elected a candidate, either a Democrat or a Republican, but in fact would rule on. This is a guy that's got polling at about 25%, and Cheney,
right,
I think, is polling at about one digit or maybe double digits if you're lucky. But
so, how to avoid it?
So, no, just walk us through what you think could happen and how he can pull it off, because this is the most unpopular guy on the planet.
Well, if indeed there is a natural catastrophe. And I think I should back this up further with some background, and that concerns the Project for the New American Century, which perhaps many of your listeners are aware of. This was basically established think tank in around 1998 or so by William Crystal and others. But it was largely consisted, the founding members consisted largely of what turned up, at least about 25 of them, of the Bush administration, including Dick Cheney. And this project for the New American Century has an ideology, and this ideology is essentially to militarize the globe and bring it under corporate control, under their control, but working with corporations to do it. And this is a very serious and vigilant attempt to control the world. And one of the, and I know this is, it sounds so James Bondish, but it's all in there. If you look at the 2000 report, Rebuilding America's Defenses, it says that it would take a new Pearl Harbor to bring off what they're trying to accomplish, which is essentially what they're saying is they would underwrite some kind of catastrophe. Now, when you add that with what's going on right now, and you understand, as you've recently, just a few moments ago, mentioned, the blatant disregard for law, the refusal to even abide by congressional subpoenas and the cancellation of habeas corpus and the use of signing statements to override congressional lawmaking authority, and on from the NSA spying program and curtailment of civil liberties. I mean, it's hard to overlook this possibility. And I'm going to put this weakly. If this is even a serious possibility, if what I'm saying is even a serious possibility, from a cost-benefit analysis, the risks are not worth not impeaching Bush. So what's up for grabs, what's so dangerous about this, is the possible demise of democracy and the rule of law in the United States.
Now, let me ask you, Ellie Conway, I saw an ad in the New York Times this week for a group that talking about the Nuremberg trials in terms of IG Farben and these other big corporations that funded the Nazis, and that they essentially got off scot-free. They got Goebbels and they got Goering and others, but they didn't go after the corporate backers of Hitler. And it was an interesting, I'm going to try and track them down to do an interview with them. It's some sort of foundation that's been set up. But that notion is very interesting, that a corp, and apparently IG Farben's motive was that they really wanted to take over the world, use Hitler to take over the world so that they control energy and pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. So is there anybody in the corporate world that really is that ambitious and would use Cheney and Bush to, because as far as I can tell, the multinationals run the world at any rate, so I don't know what more they want.
Well, I don't think, and I've emphasized this in my writings in my recent book, The Last Days of Democracy, that the media is itself ideological. It has a political ideology that it's trying to advance, and it's trying to amass power for political reasons, but it is trying to amass power for bottom line reasons. And the media, as large conglomerates and other corporations, are not moral persons, as we philosophers would say. They don't have consciences. They have bottom line interests. Their essential rule is to make money. And I think that whatever allows them to maximize their profits will be what they'll do. And right now, they have a powerful quid pro quo going on between the government and these large corporations, and I think that's what's piloting them. So are they aiming? Do they have a deliberate plan to take over the world for political reasons? I think Bush and Cheney have that idea, but I don't think the corporations are aiming at it. But it could, notwithstanding, be the result.
Right. Well, so far they've managed to screw up the world. Mm-hmm. Let me just suggest here that one of the best arguments why Nancy Pelosi should put impeachment back on the table is that she took an oath that says, "I do solemnly swear and affirm that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that I will take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of my office on which I am about to enter." So she's already made that pledge to defend and support the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and, I repeat, domestic.
And couple that with what I'm saying.
Yeah. So, but let me just in closing here ask you about you won the 2005 Project Censored Award because of the 2007, I should say, and you wrote about net neutrality, but you also connected that with the neocons you've been talking about. So elaborate, if you will.
Yes, I connected it with my later writing in the Last Days of Democracy. The original paper, Web of Deceit, which was a BuzzFlash article, is not directly addressing that issue. But do you want me to talk about the connection between the Project for the New American Century and the
takeover of the net by big corporate interests and so? But you have to be very brief if you don't mind.
I'll try. The Project for the New American Century said in their 2000 report that the internet can provide, and this is their words, an invaluable tool. Basically to be used offensively by political leaders and others, and it needs to be brought under the control of the Defense Department. And so essentially they want to take the net and turn it into a weapon of mass deception. And the ultimate goal is achievable by corporatizing it, just like they'd used the corporations in controlling the mainstream media. That's what they want to do to the net, which is ultimately to destroy net neutrality. I mean, the ultimate end, if I'm correct, is to militarize it. That is, make it a weapon of mass deception and to police it and make sure that it doesn't have anything on it that's adverse to political interests of the powers that be.
Well, I'm afraid
build a firewall around the globe.
I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Dr. Elliot Cohen.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Bye.
Just speaking then with Dr. Elliot Cohen, is an ethicist, media critic, and a political analyst, and he's recipient of the 2007 Project Censored Award. His latest book is The Last Days of Democracy, How Big Media and Power-Hungry Government Are Turning America into a Dictatorship. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, and Lick Doan, the assistant producer, and Tamika Zoghi, the engineer.